My next guest, though, is like many of us, I suppose, have had a time where we felt like walking away from our lives. It's something that my next guest actually did for real. Former soldier Christian Lewis had hit rock bottom. He was so severely depressed, he would shut himself in his flat for weeks. But one day, while he was surfing, which was his only refuge, he cast his eyes along the coast and realised that's where he wanted to be. He made an impulsive decision. He set himself the challenge of walking the entire coastline of the UK. With £10 in his pocket and a few supplies, he walked away. Christian Lewis has written about it in his first book. It's called Finding Hildesay.
So I'd been battling with, I'd say depression, definitely anxiety, but I was just not having a good time. You know, I no matter what I did, I couldn't seem to sort myself out. I was never happy in jobs I was doing and so on and so forth. And I seemed like I was in this vicious circle. And I think it comes to a point where every person just has a breaking point, don't they? And mine came. So I went down to the beach one day for a surf, and I came back up to the top of some cliffs, looked down at the coast, and something just said into my head, you know what, just walk the UK coastline. I love being outside. It's the only place where I felt happy at any point in my life. And yeah, I just went and did it.
What do you think was going on when you went out to have that surf? You weren't suicidal, but it seemed to have been a real turning point.
I don't think I was suicidal, but the kind of swell that I jumped into was not the kind of swell that anyone would normally do. It was really rough. It was really big. I definitely wasn't in a good frame of mind. And I knew once I took that leap off the ledge that there was no turning back. I couldn't get back onto the ledge at any point. So, you know, it's one of those moments you jump in and think, what have I done? So, I don't know. I felt like I needed a battle of some sort, and doing physical stuff was what I loved doing. And fortunately for me, I came out of the sea unscathed, and it was the first time in a long time where I felt really, really happy to be alive. And yeah, it was basically just after that I decided to walk the UK coastline. I wanted to keep that feeling going. I wanted to feel that sense of, it's hard to explain, but I wanted to feel alive and like I'd done something, you know, that was an achievement. And yeah, so it was a no-brainer really to just go and walk it. And I just wanted to be outside all of the time. That's where I'm a happy man.
And you were going to keep the sea on your left?
Yes, indeed.
So how do you get everything sorted for a trip where you're going to walk the entire coastline of the UK?
Well, I mean, I didn't know of anyone who'd done anything like this before, and I don't think there was any possible way that you can. I think it's just a matter of trial and error. You know, I've been pretty used to winging things my entire life. I was never the most organized person in the world. I just kind of shoot from the hip kind of guy. So I knew that there was no way that I could plan for something like this, that I would just have to learn as I go. You know, I wasn't well equipped. I didn't have very good equipment at the time. And basically most of the stuff that I had, I just borrowed. So, you know, it really was on a whim. But the further I sort of got away from Swansea and got away from my problems, I wouldn't say I was running away from them, but I was definitely sort of just needed to be extracted from the situation and just be able to give myself time to be able to think and have my own space. So that's what it done for me.
Mm. You set off, you make a start. Mm-hmm. Camping's illegal in England and Wales, though, isn't it? Just in the middle of nowhere, sort of wild camping. How did you get around that one?
It was hard work, you know. At the time I was on my own. It was a matter of just sort of sneaking into somewhere once it got dark and then going to sleep and then just being awake before it got light, because the first thing you start to see is the early morning dog walkers. So to avoid all of that, I was sneaking into anywhere and everywhere that I could, whether it be bus stops or, I remember sleeping in a Wendy house at one point. You know, just doing anything to sort of avoid any confrontation, because that's exactly what I wanted to get away from. And you know, it seemed to work, but as it went on, eventually I started my way into Scotland, and that for me was over, because they have a completely different set of laws up there, which is a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, tell me about the difference between England and Wales and Scotland when it comes to that. How does it actually work in sort of practical terms?
So yeah, you have up in Scotland, you have the right to roam. In England, in Wales, and Northern Ireland for that matter, you it's just illegal. Land ownership means effectively, the way they see it, if you're camping in their back garden, which is prohibited basically. But Scotland has a right to roam, which essentially means you can pretty much walk anywhere you want to within, you're not going to start walking and rocking up in people's back gardens and camping and all that sort of stuff. So that made things so much easier. And I remember my first night in Scotland, and I wrote about this. I'd actually had quite a bit of trouble the previous nights before this due to farmers and camping on their land and being kicked off and all this. So the first night in Scotland, I couldn't believe that that was the case, that I had the right to roam. So I just tested it, and I camped up in a spot that was really, really easy to see for everybody, in a place called Gretna. And the next morning I had no trouble that night, but the following morning someone came and shook my tent, and I really thought, oh, here we go, it's all a lie. I was paranoid and petrified. But it turns out it was a woman with her child, with a couple of bacon baps and a coffee and an offer of a shower. They didn't have any idea what I was doing. They were just genuinely being nice. And that for me was the start of my experience in Scotland. It's one of the many reasons why I fell in love with the place. And it was refreshing to say the least. For a long time, I didn't have to sneak around anymore, which was great.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more, I think, about some of those aspects. But tell me a bit about first the practicalities about this, because you really hardly had any money in your pocket. As you say, you'd borrowed some gear, your tent wasn't watertight. You ended up eating out of bins at one point.
I didn't have any really. I started with a tenner, and I don't know, that is the kind of power of the mindset that I was in at the time, how desperate I was to get away, I suppose. And there were points, I was burning so much energy during the day. I had all of my gear on my back, so I was carrying everything. And there were times when I was just a complete mess. I went in hyperglycemic at one point, and I remember sitting shaking like a leaf, and I knew that I needed food. And my only I had to resort to essentially waiting outside of McDonald's and watching people throw their leftover food in the bins, and then just, scavenging for that, basically. So it really took me back to the very basics in many ways. But sooner or later, I realized that if I was to be able to complete this, that I would need to learn to get food, not from bins. And the only way I could do that was by foraging. So I started learning foraging, and by this point, I'd lost a lot of weight. I looked really, really ill. I knew that if I continued the way that I was going, that I would end up in hospital or something like this. So, yeah, I started to learn to forage, and that saw me through for a long time.
You also encountered other military veterans who were on the streets, and that hit you pretty hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd been on the streets before. I was about to become homeless again. And it's a really, really horrible feeling, and you really can see why. When you're on the streets, I suppose you could think of it as almost a community where people start to get into things like drugs and alcohol and this sort of stuff, because it's very difficult to avoid it when you're around those groups of people. And for that brief period of time, you can put yourself onto a different planet, if you like. You can just be happy, and it's really easy to see that, and to see veterans struggling on the streets like this, and coming across them and hearing their stories, which in turn made me start opening up. It really drove me, if that makes sense. I tried to help as many of them as I could. But is that true? The saying could be more true. You've got to get out of a situation by realizing that you have a problem. And it's sad to say that that's not the case for everybody. And it broke my heart, and it was hard to see. And throughout the entire journey, no matter how hard it was, it just drove me all the time, knowing that this was having an impact on them. So, it was a real privilege.
As you walked, you noticed your thoughts beginning to change, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I would say that was when I got into Scotland. So once Scotland's fantastic, because you don't suddenly get into the wilderness. It doesn't work like that. It's very slow and gradual. And I was getting good at what I was doing at this point, but when I did, I noticed that my thoughts were on. I'd strip myself completely back to basics, and all I was thinking about was, right, don't break an ankle here, don't break a leg. Where am I going to sleep tonight? And I have to make sure I eat. So they were the only things that were my focus. And over time, everything else that was going on in my mind, all the clutter of modern day life, just started to disperse. And I realized how unimportant it was, and to a point where I couldn't believe that I stressed about it, if I'm honest with you. So that solitude of being on my own gave me a chance to find a lot about myself, about who I was and what I wanted to do with my life. And I could never have done that before, when I was, people were banging my door because they, wanted money off me or all of these other things. So it was a fight in itself, but in my eyes, it was a fight for the right thing. And It changed my life completely. Time on your own is not something people should be scared of. It's lovely.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? Because time on your own is something that often people do find quite difficult. How had you, or what had been your relationship with yourself and with being in your own company for stretches of time previously?
Well, I think for me, people give you advice and that they try and advise you, and it's always based on their situation. So, it's very easy to take advice off of people and do what they think is right, certainly if you're not in a good headspace, because you think that's the right thing to do. These people are doing well, so maybe they're right. I'll go and do this. And making the first decision myself to go and start the walk and do something that everybody else thought I was crazy doing. Turned my life around. It was the first time in my life that I had listened to my heart rather than my head, and that is so important. And being out on my own all of the time, it stripped me away from listening to what other people thought was right for me, when, to be frank, they had no idea. So it just gave me that opportunity to really dig deep and understand myself a little bit more. And that's really important for moving forward and understanding what you want to do with your life. I think it's very, very easy to get caught up in just going on the same trajectory as everybody else. Not everybody, but a lot of people are just kind of floating through life. And I always knew that I had more in me than that. So it gave me the ability to just say, no, mate, that's not good for you. That I say this with inverted commas, normal life doesn't work for me. So I need you need to do something that was just a little bit outside the box. And it turns out it's completely turned my life around. So I would suggest that to anybody.
Now, you were on your own, but also you had, or you picked up along the way, one of a start of companions. Tell me about Jet.
Yeah, so Jet came into my life 9 months into the journey, and it was an absolute turning point. It really, really was. I was just about to start doing the islands, the Hebridean islands, and I wanted to do all of them. And I knew that these places were going to be quite wild and barren. And it just didn't even cross my mind that this was a bad decision. I was in the right place at the right time, and somebody was giving her away. And yeah, the second that I met up with her, after only meeting her previous owner for a few minutes, I just saw something in her, and I think she did in me. And we just, without trying to sound too cheesy, we just fell in love with each other. And that was a game changer. It was really important to have. I couldn't have done it with another human, because I just needed that time, in my own thoughts. And Jet doesn't speak, obviously, but she gave me a focus rather than just myself. And I just don't believe there's any living creature out there that has more unconditional love for you than a dog. And yeah, she changed my world. She really, really did. And that section of the walk that I did with Jet, going through the islands and the adventures we had through all of the winters, I would say have been the favorite times in my life. They're the best times of my life. And it's actually quite sad because she's getting on a little bit now, and it's quite heartbreaking, to be honest. And yeah, she's just amazing. Dogs just have this way of tapping into your soul like a human can't. And I can't wait to have more in the future.
Interesting that you talk about your time up on the Hebrides. You encountered some pretty tough times up there, the weather for a start. Also, you had to become pretty resourceful when it came to looking after yourself. You cracked a tooth in a pretty amazing way and had to deal with it, and you had to deal with an ankle that you injured on up on Islay, I think it was.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things that I loved about this journey more than anything was finding out about myself. I don't really think a lot of people really ever find really what they're made of, if you like, because you have to put yourself into positions that are either scary or risky. And it's so true, the feeling, the saying, sorry, that you feel that you're most alive when you're put in dangerous positions. And we were doing that for a lot of time, and accidents were always going to happen. I knew this, and I was always kind of ready for it. But yeah, my tooth, Jet dog bowl, I stupidly had on the side of my bag at the time, and I learned from that mistake. It swung in the wind and cracked me in the face, knocked me out, hit my tooth, cracked it, and I ended up having to yank that out. I had no way of getting any help, so I yanked it out with the help of a little bit of whiskey, if I'm honest, but with a rabbit snare. So I yanked those out, and Yeah, I did my ankle in really badly on an Isla, and I was a long way from getting any help. So, you know, it's those kind of times when you realize that how you are as a person, and you know how not to panic and what that does. You know, panic is a killer, in more than one way, and certainly in situations of desperation and you know, what am I going to do next? You really have to remain calm and focused and stuff like this. And I never ever see them as. Or saw them as setbacks as such. I saw them as a way to learn a little bit about me, what I'm capable of, pushing my limits, and yeah, it's just listen, it's a learning curve and a driving force for all the things that I want to do in the future. I now know that I don't panic in these situations, and I'm looking forward to doing more stuff that hopefully doesn't make me have to do it
How do you not panic?
again. You just it's hard. You can't teach that kind of thing. You just have to take deep breaths. You know, just assess the situation and just tell yourself, look, it's all good, it's all okay, you're going to be absolutely fine. The only time it's not going to be fine is if you panic. So I would just sit there and just, right, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I have to do, there's no choice in the matter, there's no point whinging about it, you just got to get on with it. So yeah, just doing it, basically just solving the problem, hitting it face on, and not sitting there feeling sorry for yourself. That's really, really important, and yeah, it's a good way to be throughout every aspect of life.
You're listening to Saturday Morning on RNZ National with Susie Ferguson. My guest is Christian Lewis. His new book is Finding Hildesay, and we will get on to Hildesay shortly, hopefully. But tell me a little bit about this, I suppose, what was happening, perhaps in the background somewhat. A bit of a social media buzz was beginning to go here.
Yeah, it was crazy. I was never in it for any publicity or any sort of attention, if you like. I came to get away from it all. But I think what was happening was, I really had start to open up on my walk, and I was always posting on social media and showing people stuff, because more than anything, because I just got so excited when I was seeing something amazing that I just wanted to show everybody else. But yeah, over time, like the press started getting involved with it, television started getting involved with it, you know, news channels, all this sort of stuff. And I couldn't quite believe it, if I'm honest with you. But yeah, I found quite overwhelming at times. I really sort of, like I said, I wasn't in it for that. But the people, the main thing for me was the people that were on my page, the love and support that I was getting from them, you know, when I was having challenging days or challenging weeks or even months through winters. The warmth that I received from people, and sort of like the keep going, mate, you're doing awesome, you know, really, really helped me. And more than anything, I got to see a wonderful, wonderful side of humanity that you don't hear about on television or radio as such. Sorry, not radio, on news. And yeah, I had a real privilege in showing that off. So yeah, I was really, really proud that my pages had become a really happy and positive place rather than any trolling or negativity or anything like that. I was very proud of that. And there's so many good people out there, and fortunately, I have every one of my pages one of those. So yeah, I was really proud of that, if I'm honest with you.
And I guess that brings us back to the kindness of strangers, both online and offline. And those kinds of things were really brought home to you, I suppose, things like your first Christmas away. That kind of thing perhaps underlined that kindness of strangers, the unexpected nature of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I stayed on I got a little dinghy over to an uninhabited island off the west coast of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides for Christmas. I just thought, you know, another little challenge, let's do this. And I just thought it'd be so cool to do something like that. And there I was sitting on this island on my own on Christmas Day, and out of the blue, this boat turns up and a family come up and bring in a Christmas dinner and plenty of whiskey to accompany it. And we all just sat around this fire, you know, with these completely random people on an uninhabited island, you know, in the Atlantic, sort of having whiskey and just having a great time, all just living in the moment and just loving life. It was those kind of moments that, when I looked back to the beginning of the walk, if I'd have thought then, you know, this is how I'd want it to be, you know, that is exactly it. And I couldn't have dreamed that it was going to end up the way it did, but I saw lots and lots and lots of stuff like that throughout the journey. And yeah, this, I've written about it in my books, and I will never, ever, ever forget it. And I'll always tell stories of these things, because how often do you get to do something like that on a whim?
Indeed, well, you never know.
Yeah, fair enough.
Tell me though about about Hildersey, you probably have to tell us where Hildersey is.
Sure. So at this point, I was up in Shetland. Shetland's the most northern part of the UK. To give you an idea, it's north of Bergen in Norway. You wouldn't think that somewhere in the UK. So it's quite far up north. And yeah, I've been there since the November, and lockdown came in, and I didn't really know anything about COVID. I knew that it was there and all this sort of stuff, but because I wasn't watching news or reading any media or anything like this, I didn't know too much, just word of mouth from a few people. But one day somebody came and said, lockdown's coming in, a fisherman called Victor. Where do you want to go? And I was like, well, I can't just camp here. And he ended up just taking me to this uninhabited island for the duration of lockdown. And it was just amazing. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't the sort of island where you'd have palm trees and coconut trees falling off your head. You know, it wasn't quite the Tom Hanks sort of island, but it was 108 hectares of just nothing apart from me, my dog, and some sheep. And, you know, I spent the entire first lockdown there, and it was just incredible. It really, really was. It took about 45 minutes to get out to this island, depending on the weather. So I was really cut off from everything and everyone, and I thrived. I absolutely loved it. It was perfect.
Because you had no home to go to, you know, as the world was shutting down. And I mean, people will remember this time and how lots of people right around the world were scrambling to, you know, to get back home. And you didn't, you kept on going.
Yeah, do you know what? I was so enjoying the adventure, and I'd worked so hard up until this point. I thought I didn't have a home to go to. No, I was homeless. But I'm pretty sure friends or family would have helped if I'd have asked. But I just thought, do you know what? No, I want to continue this adventure, and I want to stay on it. I don't want to keep walking, because everyone else has got to stay at home. Then I'm going to stay put as well. So when Victor said about it, I just thought, yeah, I didn't even think about it. Didn't even think how it was possible or how I was going to survive out there. It was just a straight out yes, and I worry about that when it comes to it. So yeah, you know, I just wanted to stay true to the walk, and also I thought, if people are going to be locked up at home, I'm pretty sure that's going to get a lot of people down. So I wanted to remain as positive and as active as I possibly could, just to show them that, you know, even though it's a lockdown and you have to stay at home, you know, you can still achieve, you can still do things. So I made sure that I did, and fortunately for me, you know, that helped a lot of people during lockdown.
Where did you stay?
Well, I started just in the tent, but there was a Scandinavian-style house there that hadn't been lived in for years and years. Sadly, the gentleman that owned it had passed. So somebody on mainland Shetland had said, look, we can come over by boat and give you the key for it. It was basically four walls, but it had no running water, no gas, no electricity. Ironically, it was colder inside the house than what it was outside. But, you know, it was four walls, and it stopped me having to. The hardest part about being in the tent, as I learned through the journey, was the fact that if you get caught out in storms for days on end, then you are just sitting in essentially a little cocoon, and you can't stand up. You just can barely sit up. So to be able to move around and walk was just awesome. And it was the happiest that I'd ever seen my dog. And I know that because she would venture further away from my side each and every, you know, more and more each and every day. And I just got busy. I started learning how to forage better. I was catching lobster. I was catching crab, fish, you name it. I was just keeping myself busy all of the time. Every single day I had a plan to go out and get fitter and get stronger and just get better at things that I wanted to. And that was foraging. So, yeah, I came off that island a much better and stronger person.
You had some pretty extraordinary opportunities for wildlife spotting as well on this trip, didn't you?
Oh, it was absolutely incredible. Yeah, you know, I'd woken up in the morning to, in the tent, unzip my tent to hear splashing around, just looking at whales outside of my tent, you know, constantly just watching golden eagles, sea eagles, thousands, well, so many different types of birds, you name it, even ones that came from Antarctica, they Arctic terns to come and breed. So the island itself was essentially, we're coming into March at this point, and it was just one big bird's nest, and thousands of birds would just hover above my head at night time and in first thing in the morning, and I would just lay outside with Jet and just close my eyes and listen to it. And listen, there is no better television than that, I can promise you. I can close my eyes now and remember those noises. You know, it's a beautiful place to be in life, and no wonder I feel so at peace with myself and so relaxed. It's just lovely.
And so finding Hildersey ends there, ends with the lockdown. Your story doesn't end there, though, does it? Because there's a sequel?
Yeah, so my second book has just come out. So the first book took me up until I was on Hildesay. And then my second book, which is called Hildesay to Home, just got published this week. And that is the story about the next part of the adventure, which is where I bumped into my now fiancé.
Tell us about your fiancé. Tell us about, you know, obviously you have Jet. That's your first companion as you do this.
My favourite one, I'll be honest with you. My favourite one.
I hope you're out of earshot of Kate.
Yeah, I am. Don't worry.
But tell me about how you met Kate.
So I had just come out of the lockdown and I had 3 weeks left on Shetland to do. And I returned back to mainland Scotland. And no longer than a month after lockdown, I was down at the bottom of a cliff, camped up. And she just come trundling down. And, you know, she was really intrigued with what I was doing. We only spoke for like 3 or 4 minutes. And then she disappeared. And then about 40 minutes later, she returned with some fish and chips, two cans of Tennent's, and asked if she could come and camp next to me. She just wanted to know more. And we just hit it off. You know, we spent the whole night just talking and talking and talking. And she sadly had to go back the next day because she had work commitments. But we kept in touch for the next 6 weeks and we just became best friends. We really, really did. And our first date, essentially, she came back up to Scotland to come and see me. I feel like we got to know each other really well by this point. And Kate decided to not return home and come and join me for the rest of the walk.
Amazing. Romance isn't dead.
Yeah, it does happen. It's so funny. I always say to people, you know, I spent all those years, you know, I was single for a long time looking for the perfect partner. It turns out all you have to do is not wash, not shave and be absolutely stinking. And then, hey, presto, women of my dreams.
And so she joined you on the walk?
Yes, she did. She come and joined me from the northeast tip of Scotland. And stayed with me all the way until the end. And, you know, I was ready to have a partner at this point. But, you know, we never expected that somebody else would be popping along only a year after. So about a year into the journey, Kate and I, we had a punctured roll mat. And somebody had offered us some stables to come and sleep in because it had hay bales in it. So we thought that'd be really, really comfortable. And it was around Kate's birthday in August. And Kate said that she felt really, really weird. And I said, look, do you think there could be a chance that you're pregnant? So anyway, cut a long story short, we were sat on top of these hay bales and Kate did a pregnancy test and we found out that we were having a little baby. So we were just absolutely delighted. You know, Kate and I had spent every single living minute together. I would say normally, you know, people, they meet up and they'll go to work and then, you know, they'll see each other for, you know, the weekends or in the evenings and stuff like this. But Kate and I were just together all of the time. So we knew that this was working. And not long after that, 9 months after that, a little baby boy, Magnus, appeared and Kate walked all the way up. You know, she slept in a tent and walked all the way up till 3 weeks before she gave birth. And she is some woman, I tell you that.
That's extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. Thinking of family, how did you stay in touch with family while you were on this epic journey?
Well, I didn't really too much certainly in the first couple of years because I just had no money. I couldn't do it. All of my energy and effort was going into the social media side of things. So I just had to make sure at the time I had credit on my phone to be able to do that. So they knew that I just kind of wanted to get away from it all and just kind of left me to it, you know. And as it got easier and we got in more signal as we started hitting the East Coast, then, you know, things got a lot easier at that point. And also Kate had been working full time. She had a contract phone. So I was able to use that to keep in touch. But other than that, you know, we didn't keep in touch loads. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity. So I just got on with it and I spent a lot of time to myself and, I loved every single minute of it, if I'm honest.
You said earlier on, normal life doesn't work. So what do you do now?
I've written a couple of books now and I can't get it into my head how this has all happened. I'm going to be honest with you, I haven't read a book since school. I can't even spell for that matter. But to think that I've become an author, it's quite hilarious. But, you know, the first one become a Sunday Times bestseller. I've just found out the second one is as well. So, you know, the money that we've had, what we've done is we've ploughed it all into getting a nice van for ourselves to be able to start adventuring again. And that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to get straight back out there. We're going to, live as what we call a wilderness family. We call ourselves on social media now. And yeah, we're just going to show people that you can, not just to show them, it's because we love doing it, but that you can live a sort of alternative life and be happy. I think the main thing for us and our biggest asset, we could have decided to not buy at the moment, but certainly rent a house and just gone back to the conventional way of living. But no way, why fix what's not broken? We love being outside. We love adventuring. We love being our own bosses. And, like I said, our biggest asset is the fact that we don't own a lot of things. So we're not beholden to anything. So all of our love and passion in life comes from experiences. So we don't need all the computers and 50 cars and 10 houses. We just like being each other's company, and that's success and happiness to us. We're very fortunate.